Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 72 now of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Scroobius Pip. That's me. This week's guest, very exciting, and a wonderful chat. I've been hyping this for 2-3 episodes now because I really it's great. It's a guy called Dale Vince. He's the founder of Ecotricity. And yeah, it's just really good. I was approached by someone in his office who's a fan of the podcast and just said, look, I think this might be of interest. And they sent me a load of stuff. And, generally I get a lot of these and it doesn't quite fit. But I read the stuff he sent and there was some interesting stuff. And whilst I'm not a journalist, so I don't generally book people that I know I'm going to 100% disagree with, because I'm not interested in that. This isn't, in fact, my full-time job, you should be aware. This is a part-time job. These are just conversations that I enjoy and want to enjoy having, not necessarily people I want to shoot down or interrogate or grill. It's why I've never had and never planned to have a politician on. I don't support and agree with our current political system. Therefore, even if there's a politician that has some views that align with mine, I don't agree with their existence, essentially, currently in the current form. So I've no plans to have any politicians on. But this was a fascinating one. And I went in sceptical and ready to maybe argue some points or maybe to hear some stuff that sounds cool but actually isn't really all that. But I didn't hear any of that. It's fascinating. I need to get the quick plug of speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's my record label. Head there and buy merch and stuff. Support me, support the podcast, support the label. That's the shortest I've ever done that. But yeah, it's a fascinating chat and I'm excited for you to hear it. So I'm going to get straight into that now. At the end, I will have some more information for you and some more chatting as we're coming towards the end of the year. Another emotional year in the Distraction Pieces podcast world. This is Dale Vince of Ecotricity. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And that was the big start. There we go. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. Yeah, a little bit damp. I just got caught in the rain on my motorbike.
Yeah. It's not the nicest of days. I'm joined today by Dale Vince, the founder of Ecotricity. And this is a really interesting podcast for me because it's the first one I've really done with a company, essentially, or that's to do with a company. I've been approached numerous times to do sponsored guests as such, so different companies have said, oh, we've got a really interesting person, can we pay to have a podcast? And I've always said no, and I wanted to make it clear at the start of this that that's not what's happening here either. This isn't a sponsored slot. This is a guy, Max, approached me and just gave me a load of information on what you guys do, and particularly with the climate change conference and everything going on at the moment, it seemed like a really interesting chat to have. So thank you for coming on.
Hey, no problem, it's my pleasure, actually. Thanks for doing it.
So I mean, let's just start off with what Ecotricity is. It was the first green energy company in the world when you set it up, right? And you set up 20 years ago now, was it?
Yeah, it was in the mid-90s, so yeah, it is 20 years ago. Yeah, mad but true. We were the first people in the world to sell this new kind of electricity, green electricity.
Yeah. And what kind of inspired that? Like, what was your path to that?
My path to that, the previous 10 years I'd been living on the road as what some people call a new age traveller.
Yeah.
And that was itself inspired by the desire to live a different kind of life, you know, a low impact life. And a life without kind of, all of the normal things like a job and a mortgage and, you know, that path that we're all supposed to take. I just absolutely rejected that as a young person. And I wanted to do my own thing in the world and be self-sufficient as far as I could and explore and find my way, really, rather than go straight from school, straight into the world of work. And there's very little difference between them, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So 10 years on the road, living in buses and trucks and all sorts of funny things that I built myself, and I became very self-reliant. And by the end of that period, I was using small windmills to power my trailer. And so that kind of put me in tune with the whole renewable energy kind of issue. And one day I saw the first big wind farm built in Cornwall. It was about 91 or something like that. And I just was inspired by the thought that I could spend another 10 years living this impact, low impact lifestyle myself, or I could drop back in and try and build a big windmill on the hill I was living on at the time. And it was only that thought, really, and I was just inspired by the idea to do it. So I set out to do exactly that. That was the beginning.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I love that it came from your own survival methods, really, that what you learnt about renewable energy came from needing renewable energy, like directly being on the road, being on the move, not being able to, / choosing not to tap into to what's already provided and the electric systems and general systems of society that were already set up and provided. So learning that and then going, right, I've learnt this for myself, I can probably learn this for a broader audience, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, us hippies, we used to sit around a fire at night, you know, for example, and we used to say things like, they should do this, they should do that,
yeah,
because we were all dabbling in small wind and sustainability issues and stuff, you know. And I suppose in a way, I just thought, well, look, maybe I should be the they.
Yeah.
Let's drop in and try and do something. And at the early part of that journey, I learned that electricity generation in our country is the biggest single cause of climate change.
Oh, wow.
30% of all carbon emissions come from burning fossil fuels to make electricity. So it seemed doubly sensible to me to push renewable energy. The biggest single thing we can do to fight climate change is change where our energy comes from.
Yeah, yeah. And that's
a nice message.
I mean, again, as well, it must have been a big decision and a bold move to say, right, I'm going to, rather than just thinking about myself and thinking about my own sustainability, to make that jump to go, right, well, as you said, it's very common for people to sit around and go, here's what's wrong, yes, here's what they're doing
that's
wrong.
Right.
But it's also very common, particularly on the left side, or it has been traditionally, to go no further than that. You know, in politics, in energy, in anything else, to talk about all the problems, but only talk about it. So, yeah, that must have been a huge deal when you first decided to go, right, let's become the they. Let's take that action and make those changes myself. So how was that? I'd imagine it wasn't a quick fix or a quick move.
No, it definitely wasn't quick. It took 5 years to build that first windmill on that hill I lived on.
Wow.
And it's fair to say when I decided to do it, I had no idea what it would take. I didn't know about big windmills, the world of finance, grid connections, planning, all that kind of stuff. So what I did is I just tackled it one thing at a time. And learned on the way. Had to fight various battles, and all told, it strung it out to a period of 5 years. And by just before I built the turbine, the first one went up on Friday, the 13th of December, 1996. I can't forget the date. It was a magic date. Just before, I went to see the local power company because I was thinking about building the next one. And tried to sell them the idea of green electricity. They were monopoly buyers at the time. If you were generating electricity, you had to sell it to them. So I went to see them, and they just laughed at the idea. They said, you know, who wants green electricity? And by the way, here's a rubbish price because you've got nobody else you can go to.
Yeah.
And I left that meeting deciding that the only way to build more was to get a fair price for the energy. And the only way to do that was to cut out those middlemen and reach the end user with this new thing, this green electricity. And so born of that meeting was the idea to go a step further, just from building a windmill to actually being an energy company and delivering it to somebody's house.
Yeah.
And that was another massive adventure, I have to say.
Again, yeah, I can imagine that's a huge thing. But again, logical in many ways that it's probably often easier to change the minds of the customer and the user than of the company who are making millions of dollars from the way they do it and have always done it. You know, quite understandably, it's going to be hard to change their mind, whereas the user who has a natural hate of their electricity bill, you know, that's kind of a thing that no one looks forward to, they're probably an easier target, again, albeit a longer game and a gradual road, but an easier person to convince than someone sitting in an office who goes, mate, we've got it made. We generate all this. We charge a fortune for it. There's no other racket in town.
Yeah.
You know, we're not interested.
No, you're right. It's a status quo, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're about preserving. And I think that's what the government have shown themselves to be doing today with Amber Rudd's latest announcement, you know, that she's going to put a lot of money into new gas-fired power stations.
Yeah.
Having said just a few weeks ago that she's ending subsidies for renewable energy because things need to stand on their own 2 feet.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make any sense with all the money being poured into nuclear, fracking and gas. That's about the status quo. Fossils and nuclear, this is what the Tories are for.
Yeah.
And they're really shutting down the renewables industry. But you're right. In our work, we try to reach the people. We use people power as a kind of, it's not a catchphrase or a slogan, but it's an expression of ours with a colon in between the two. And what we try to explain in doing that is that our work is enabled by people. We have a bills into mills model where we harness people's energy bills and we use the money from that to build windmills, solar mills, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we put their energy bills to good purpose, but it's a virtuous cycle. The more customers we have, the more we can build. That's our people power thing. And I think you're absolutely right. You've got to reach past the institutions, the business as usual people, reach the end user and say, look, there's a better way to do this.
Yeah.
And it's people power that I think that can change the world.
And I mean, it must have been a huge thing to get over that initial a customer base, because until you've got that, people will say there's always been talk of wind power, of solar power, of all these things. I remember, again, in the 90s, I guess, or maybe even late 80s, all the talk of solar panels on your houses and that being the future, but then there being it being damned in many ways of it's not actually that, it doesn't produce that much energy and all these kind of things. So it must be nice now, obviously. It's still a midpoint in the journey, but it must be good now to be able to go, no, look, we are, you know, a legitimate company. We provide a lot of people already. This is a valid and sustainable option rather than that. Again, it sounded like a hippie fantasy.
It's great to have come this far and to be so well established as a company and as a concept, really, renewable energy and all that kind of stuff. As you say, I mean, back in the day, nobody really believed that anybody would want green energy. Nobody believed that we could deliver it at the same price as brown, which is one of our founding principles. And I remember facing a choice at the beginning, thinking about this, how am I going to do this? This is a great cause, change the way energy is made. I saw two routes. One is to be, in effect, a charity, to knock on people's doors and say, look, this is a great cause, you should help out, it's going to cost you, but it's a good thing to do. The other was to do it as a business and knock on doors and say, look, this is a great thing to do and it won't cost you any money.
Yeah.
And we took that route. So business for us is a tool, it's a means to an end. You know, we see ourselves more as a social enterprise than a conventional business because of our bills into mills, dividend type model. But that's always been our premise, to really go to people with an offer that they can't refuse.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want green energy if it's pretty much costing you the same as the brown stuff?
And that's what really struck me and excited me about this is that exact thinking there. Because the fact is, if you go the charity route, there's so many charities and so many very worthy causes. I mean, you see it now on social media that every month has got two or three different things that it's a charity for. So it's easy to get passed over in that manner. I had a rapper on called Killer Mike, and I was talking to him about the responsibility of rap to put back into the community and help the community. And he blew my mind in saying, I do believe there is a responsibility, but again, it doesn't have to be a charity thing. He's like, I've now got three barbershops in my local area and we employ a local people. I get all my merch made locally. So you can still be a businessman and be taken seriously by everyone in that way. Again, as a business, you can be taken seriously by all sorts of people, regardless of if they're, as you said, hippies or whatever else. And that's a strong point to approach from. So how was it when you first started kind of approaching people? What was the at a method, like, did it have to start as literally a door-to-door, or was it...
Yeah, I can remember that very first conversation. Just before I tell you about it, just to say, I think that the business approach that you were just describing there compared to the charity is actually more sustainable.
Yeah.
I think the charity approach doesn't have the legs. If you can create a world in which jobs are created and people are employed and there's a good outcome from business, inverted commas, then that's much more sustainable.
It sustains itself long-term rather than the goodwill of a group of people at that point who could then die or move on to something else, or it doesn't become a sustainable thing.
Exactly right. Yeah, so look, I remember that first conversation. It was just up the road in Cheltenham, and it was a technical college, Cheltenham, I forget the exact name of it, but knocked on the door, spoke to the energy manager, and I remember the first thing he said about it. He said, you know, will the lights go out?
Yeah.
And do I need to change my meter? Kind of, there was a complete lack of belief and understanding in how this worked. And,
and
even now, I think a lot of people in this country don't understand that you don't have to change anything. We're all plugged into the national grid, most of us plugged into the national grid. And anybody can supply your electricity.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do anything about it. And the lights will not go out, depending on who supplies your electricity, because the national grid takes care of that on behalf of all suppliers. But back in the day, we were this new thing, an independent energy company. We're the oldest one in Britain, by the way. Mm. And yeah, energy, it was businesses we were talking to first. And this energy manager chap was like, oh, I don't know, will it work?
Yeah.
Which is a fairly fundamental barrier to get over.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it is fascinating because there are just general barriers in people's perceptions of what their options are. And we normally get kind of plugs in or whatnot at the end. But again, are you saying that then? It hadn't really crossed my mind that it was not like I know who my electrical supplier is and things like that. But that was the supplier when I moved into my house.
Yeah.
But the fact is, anyone can go to your... Well, what's the best way to go to your website or what? And
yes, Horses for Courses. If you like to do online stuff, go to our website and you can do it in about 5 minutes. It's like name, address and postcode and you're almost done. Or give us a call and do it over the phone. It's the same amount of time, but it's whichever people prefer. It's actually, we put a lot of work into making it really easy. The energy industry is behind, the telecoms industry, I would say by a decade, maybe two, in terms of its user-friendliness and stuff. But we're doing our best to bring it up to speed.
Yeah, so, and again, not to sound completely ignorant here. I mean, it's my role to be ignorant here, but you provide to everywhere in the country, right? Essentially, everywhere on the grid. It's not a case of, which I'd imagine it would have been when you started, kind of being more of a local, you know, you've got your areas, you've got your windmill here, this can serve here, here and here.
Yeah, two things really. Firstly, you're dead right. Doesn't matter where you live in Britain, if you're connected to the grid, we can supply you. And we do. We have customers absolutely everywhere, which is great. But when we first began, we came up with a new model of supply. We called it embedded supply. And what we did was we matched local generators. The first one was a landfill gas generator. And we matched it to local customers, first one being Cheltenham College, because they did sign up.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
And the lights didn't go out, right?
The lights didn't go out.
Fantastic news.
Right. And because what I learned as I took a deep dive into the energy industry was that, to use a kind of a metaphor, the national grid is actually the motorway network.
Yeah.
But coming off every junction, you've got a local grid. And if you stay in the local grid, matching your generation to your customers, you avoid, let's say, the tolls of using the motorways. So in order to deliver green for the price of brown, back in the early days, we came up with this new model of embedded supply, matching local generators to local users.
Right.
Since then, we've gone national with it, and you know, we've kind of smoothed those issues out. It was good fun.
Yeah,
back
yeah,
in the day doing that, and an embedded supply was a radical idea. We had some issues with it,
I
recall.
I can imagine. So what kind of... I mean, after being essentially laughed out of the room when approaching the power companies, essentially, as you started to grow as a provider yourself, having customers yourself, what kind of reaction have you seen or did you start to get from the original... from the brown energy providers, essentially?
But it's funny, really, because it might have been 10 years later. It might have been a little bit less, but not by much. They actually came to see us, asked if they could have a meeting. And basically, they came to ask if there was any way they could work with us.
Which
is nice. But there wasn't, you know, they had no ideas and we couldn't see anything. Otherwise, we would have done, you know, we didn't hold a grudge or anything.
Yeah, sure.
But actually, yeah, we'd gone full circle from them thinking it was a silly idea. You know, and they weren't prepared to actually be fair with us on price, to saying, anyway, we can work with you because this looks quite successful.
Yeah, again, and that's the wonderful irony with these things is we will achieve so many different things. And I think in energy, in medicine, in all these different areas, if the people upstairs with the money can see it as a financially viable and profitable thing, the sad thing there is, because the fact is no one can really deny that at some point we need to go greener and greener and greener and become sustainable. That's something everyone has been aware of. So as soon as the big companies can see a way of doing that and still making their profit, then it's logical to them to switch over. But the beauty there is, I mean, I'd imagine in many ways, although they're essentially your rivals, that's also something that you want, because that's kind of for the good of everyone.
Yeah.
But the beauty there will be, when that does happen, you'll be the seasoned experts of providing this, of running this, and they'll be the ones kind of going, all right, so how can we convert what we've got here and things like that, you know?
Yeah, I think they'll always be playing catch-up in that scenario.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always held it to be the case myself that there are two ways we can bring change. The one is to do it ourselves,
yeah,
and whatever we're physically capable of building and customers recruiting and that kind of stuff, that creates a certain amount of change. The other amount is as a catalyst. By showing other people that what we do is successful and people want it, then other companies come and do it. So we've been followed by the big six, as they're known, energy companies, into a number of the things that we do, like green tariffs and something we call merchant wind, which is where you build a big windmill on a factory.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. And yeah, absolutely, I welcome it, because the more people that join in, the more change we create between us.
Yeah. So let's talk about the main forms of energy production you have. Is it mainly wind that is the strongest? It's strange from touring. I seem to notice a lot more wind farms the further north you go, and not so many south for some reason. But yeah, is it a growing, an ever growing thing, and is that the main source?
Yeah, we began with onshore wind energy, and I would say it's Britain's preeminent form of renewable energy. You know, it's the one that's most abundant and it's the cheapest. Mm. So it's the one that's got the most to offer. I mean, there's enough of it, for context, to power the whole country four times over if we used it all. You tend to see more windmills further north because there's more wind, and there's a cube law relationship in wind, which means if you double the wind speed at a given site, a windmill will make eight times as much energy. The economics in Scotland are vastly better than the economics in the south of England.
Yeah, of course.
So that's one reason for that. But since we began in onshore wind, solar has come along, and I would say particularly in the last few years, it's made massive leaps in terms of its cost of energy. And the key to all of this is the cost per unit of electricity that you can generate.
Yeah.
You know, it's about making a business-like proposition. The price of solar has fallen so dramatically that it's you know, it's gone from being a long way behind onshore wind to being pretty close now and being quite viable in a number of circumstances. And there's been a small tsunami of solar roofs installed under the feed-in tariff, which the Labour government initiated a few years ago. That's been cut now, and all of that is going to stop. But so we see electricity coming from the wind, the sun, and the sea, you know, Britain is blessed with enough of that to power the whole country many, many times over.
Yeah.
And that creates for us something we call energy independence. We don't need to bring energy in from you know, other parts of the world, which can be unstable on the one hand, but also it makes us subject to global prices for fossil fuels. You know, in the last 8 years, the price of energy bills has gone up, you know, something like £600 or something. Most of that has come from the rise of the price of fossil fuels on global markets. It hasn't come from anything else, and we are absolutely subject to it. When it comes to gas, we also have a kind of new approach to that, which we haven't mentioned yet. Because up until a few years ago, we thought we only had the answer for electricity and that we just had to stop using gas. But we've just launched this year a new approach, which is to make gas from grass, improbably, grown on marginal farmland, and we can scrub that gas up and put it into the gas grid in the way we can our green electricity.
Oh, wow.
And we've done some research, and there's enough marginal land in Britain to produce 95% of all of the gas we use today. By 2030, we'll be using half as much gas if we hit our carbon target. So there's plenty of land to make all the gas we need in the coming decades as the North Sea runs out. And our method is a kind of share farming method using 15-kilometer circles of land with all the farmers in that area growing grass on marginal land. It creates habitats for wildlife, it's just good all round. And it's the alternative to fracking. There's no danger from it.
Yeah,
it's carbon neutral. It creates jobs, and it's energy made in Britain that will be sustainable. Is sustainable.
Yes, so that must be a huge thing for you at the moment to have found or started to break the back of the gas problem. I mean, that's a fascinating thing to have found a way. And again, almost ironically, are you using grass, the ultimate of green symbols and energy, to use that to start to replace and provide that. Yeah. That's amazing.
I was very excited when we came upon it. Just because, I say, for all these years, as an environmentalist, I felt we had half the answer. And the other half was to stop using gas. But now we have the whole answer, and we could power the whole country from our own made electricity and gas. I mean, it's a wonderful vision of what the future could look like.
Yeah. Do you think there's a risk of resistance to energy independence due to what can be done through the trading of energy around the world? If every country became... The dream should be that every country becomes energy independent, but that's also one of the biggest rackets in the world, obviously, at the moment, as we've seen from financial trading to illegitimate wars and invasions. The global trading of gas and energy and oil is a huge thing.
It is a really big deal, isn't it? I mean, the current super low price of oil and petrol is most people would tell you driven by Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Depressing the price of oil in order to break the US fracking industry.
Right. Yeah.
As an environmentalist, I'm not unhappy about the outcome they're seeking.
That's kind of a good goal there.
Yeah. But of course, they're doing it for their own purposes. Once they've done that, they put the price back up and that kind of stuff. But you're right. I mean, it's a big racket. And just to touch on another point you made there, what if we all became energy independent? I do think that the idea of globalization has gone too far. The idea that we need to be buying things from the other side of the world and, in effect, exporting responsibility as well as jobs to other countries. Most of it, I think, was driven by an economic imperative that people in the developing world were just paid so little that we could get this stuff so much cheaper, and that helped our standard of living, which I think is an awful reason for doing it.
Yep.
But, I believe in creating jobs here in Britain, taking responsibility for the things that we want and need, and to make them here, and energy included in all of that. I think globalization is a bad concept.
Yeah. Actually.
I'm not an isolationist. Completely. I want to be a part of the world, but I think we all should be taking responsibility as far as we possibly can for what we need as a country.
Again, completely. I think there's a very wide an idea I support greatly. I love the idea of individual sustainability. I love nothing more than the idea of living in a hut somewhere and being able to provide everything for myself. Yeah. So if we can see that would kind of be the best, but there's millions of people who wouldn't want anything to do with that. Yeah. Then the idea of building a structure in our country where we can sustain ourselves, but that energy be provided, not having to go out and start your own fires and everything else, actually living the lives that we live now, but with that, individual... sustainability.
Yeah, definitely. And I think technology is a big role to play. We can't all be lighting individual fires and stuff like that, for example, but the smart grid is a really important part of what's coming. The Internet of Things is kind of linked to that. And, for me, it's just about the nonsensicalness, if I can use that as a term, of this, this approach to globalization, which says, well, look, we'll just buy this stuff from China because it's cheaper, and the cheapness of fossil fuels enables that to happen. All of this has a terrible environmental impact as well as social impact. When we should be making things here, the things that we want, and employing people here rather than throwing them on the dole and employing people in a sweatshop somewhere else, you know. I just think that's irresponsible. But that's, you know, that's driven by, you know, the worst forms of capitalism. The ones just look at the bottom line, don't care about the impacts on other people and the planet.
Of course, of course. How much, when running the company, how much time has to be split between finding solutions to these problems, finding the technology to go more green, more independent, and versus how much time has to be spent kind of convincing people and winning them over and convincing them that, that it's not just a silly pipe dream or that global warming isn't a real, and all these different things. Kind of, there is an awful lot of that, particularly in England. England and the US are kind of renowned for the kind of denial of the way things are, or just for going, that all sounds very nice, but not taking it seriously. You know, what's the balance there, and what do you have to do as a daily fight against that?
I understand what you're saying. It's changed since we began. You've reminded me, one of the first things we used to say to people is that climate change is a real problem. Back in the day, most people hadn't heard of it, so we'd spend a little bit of time explaining what climate change was, mm-hmm. and how it was a threat, and how the answer, therefore, was to change how we made energy, and here's some green electricity. That was the basic premise. But somewhere along the line, many years ago, we dropped the climate change part of that because it was common currency. Everybody knew what it was. I think more recently, it's been absolutely damaged by the right-wing media. They've thrown so much mud at climate change that, you know, people are going, oh, I'm either fed up with hearing about it, or there's just so much doubt about it, isn't there, you know, which there isn't.
I mean, that's it. It's providing the slightest amount of doubt. And sadly, that's all we need a lot of time. Everyone, and again, on to try and defend the British public in general, everyone's got their busy lives, everyone's got a lot to deal with and their own financial or social issues to get through. So if someone like the right-wing media can cast a bit of a question mark over it, then it's easy to go, oh, well, I don't know about that. I don't really know. I've heard this, I've heard that, I don't know.
That's how they work. And they did it recently with green energy. You know, in the last couple of years of the coalition government, there was a sustained assault on green energy, which led ultimately to the cuts and stuff like that. You know, it's a kind of softening up exercise, softening up public opinion before doing something. But we recognise what you've said there, really, which is that everybody's busy. You know, we're focused on this. This is our life's mission, but everybody else is busy doing something else. And it's very important that what we offer is simple, it's easy to do, doesn't come with a cost, but it does have a good outcome. And I would say that's our, you know, that's our basic approach to it, because if we can do that, then I think we can get enough people to say, well, look, why wouldn't I do that? That's it. And we don't
if just making it something that essentially they don't have to think about. So it'll be exactly the, like for your worry, it'll be exactly like it is now. It'll be exactly as it is, but you know there's something wrong. You know there's something that could be being done better. You'll be doing something positive there, and you don't have to.
That's a good point, because most people don't think about their energies now. You know, they shouldn't have to think too much about this one either.
Exactly. I mean, we've touched numerous times upon the Tories and the right-wing government we have at the moment and the right-wing media. You've been quite outspoken about the Tory green energy policies and I guess what they gradually started to pull apart under the coalition and then kind of had the stabiliser wheels taken off and were allowed to fully rev up and do what they want now.
I think that's fair. That's what's happened. I think we, you know, many of us were frustrated the Lib Dems didn't do more when they were in coalition, but I think we can see now what they were holding back. You know, it's like an all-out war. And today Amber Rudd made another announcement, which is anti-renewable energy. I mean, firstly, it's about building a whole load of gas-fired power stations. Trip over that, which is just madness. She's saying
gas-fired stations would be lovely.
That's right. It's total madness because you know, just weeks ago they said we can't afford renewable energy. You know, it's putting up the price of our energy bills, and anyway, these things need to stand on their own 2 feet. A few months before that, they'd signed up to 35 years contract with the nuclear industry at twice the market price for power. I mean, you know, that's a massive subsidy. Now there's going to be a subsidy for gas, but we can't afford wind energy. The IMF says that we pay, as a household, each household in Britain pays £1,000 a year to support the fossil fuel industry. That's the hidden subsidy that they get. We see a very visible £100 a year subsidy for the entire renewable energy industry, of which £10 is for wind. And for that, we get a quarter of the energy of the power we use in Britain.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
So there's such great subsidies for and again, it's kind of, it's fascinating to see, or scary to see, how governments can repeatedly not look very far into the future. And we saw it with the economic crisis, where they were gambling everything on the now, when there was clearly at some point that had to, the bottom had to fall out of that. With loans and all these other things, where they were all balancing and gambling on. Yeah. And it feels similar with this. To say we can't afford renewable energy or green energy seems so backwards, because you're saying what we can afford is something that is going to continue to become rarer and rarer, and the price therefore go higher and higher as the years go on, rather than something that can remain at this price, or can, you know, can get cheaper if more support is put into it, if more is provided. It seems so backwards. Even if, I mean, as you said, because of the subsidies, it's an inaccurate claim anyway, but even if it was true that green energy was more expensive at this point, then surely you'd be able to look towards the future and go, right, but we need to make that switch at some point.
You're quite right. But within weeks of the Tories saying we can't afford wind, we have to stop, Bloomberg put out a report that said wind energy is Britain's cheapest form of energy, bar none.
Wow.
So we're already at the point where it's cheaper than everything else. We don't have to hope for that in the future. Solar is coming down in price so quickly that by 2020 it's expected to be at grid parity. It's not far away.
Yeah.
So we're on the verge there already. And, you know, in this country, we spend £80 billion a year on fossil fuels to buy them, mostly from abroad, and to burn them, which adds to atmospheric pollution and climate change. 30,000 people a year die from air pollution in our country.
Wow.
And if we took that £80 billion and we spent it on renewable energy, just on renewable energy, and this isn't quite a quite a straight comparison, but if we spent it all on renewable energy, we could build enough wind and sun to power the country by 50% in 1 year. Every year of £80 billion, 50% of the country.
Wow.
But that £80 billion is, of course, for the energy sector, for transport, and for lots of it combined. But that's how much we burn every year in our country. And it's literally shoveling money into a furnace.
Yeah, it's absolutely madness. Insane. And it's a very strange situation at the moment, politically, that we're at a point where at least within the realms of how far left and right it actually goes. In the UK, we have a government to the right, but our big best buddies and idols are America, who are currently under a democratic rule. So it's a very unusual balancing act there of... Is there a difference in America at the moment? Are they trying to push more green? Again, like when Obama was first coming in, there was a lot of talk of that. I don't think it's gone the way everyone expected, but there's a lot of money and a lot of people behind the scenes with a lot of power who would be directly invested in it not going that way. But
I mean, from my perspective, they have the same kind of arguments, left and right, green and brown. And Obama is like Blair. You know, he came in with a lot of promise, and I would say he's probably under-delivered for a lot of people. I had high hopes. You know, I don't live in America. But he's done some good things at the same time. Tony Blair did some good things. But I have to say, I think, and I meant to say earlier, your point about the government's current decisions not being logical, it's not based in science or economics or anything, it's short term. I think it's ideology. And I do think there's a left and right split here on green issues. I think sustainability, the environment, green energy is a kind of lefties thing. And people to the right of the spectrum, they like nuclear energy. It's big, it's complicated, it's bloody expensive. They don't mind the risks. We're men.
Yeah.
We take that, you know. They like to burn fossil fuels. You know, they like big industries.
Sure.
You know, and so I do think it's a psychological thing, actually. Yeah. And it falls to the left of the spectrum.
And again, it's an ever-evolving argument as well, I think. I think 5 years ago or 10 years ago, a lot of people, and again, it may not be what I would agree with or you would agree with at the time, but you could understand a lot of people's question marks over where green is going, are what the options are. And as said, of the sustainability of it all. And the fact was, there were points where it was a kind of, I don't know, a risk versus achievement or performance, I guess. But as you've said, the leaps and bounds that seem to have come on in the last few years, yeah, seem to start to rub that out. Yeah. How do you go about continually re-educating and updating people on? Because again, if someone had looked into this 5-10 years ago, they may have, even with a quite broad or intelligent mind, have come to their decision that no, the correct option is nuclear or whatever else. Mm. How do you kind of reach those people, or what's your?
That's a tough one, isn't it? I do think that one of the jobs is to constantly re-educate yourself, because the world changes really quickly. And yeah, I would say 10 years ago, I think the people in power did recognise what you said earlier, which is that green energy may be more expensive now, but it's worth supporting, because yeah, it will get cheaper over yeah time. And anyway, we have to fight climate change, and yeah, that's probably the biggest deal of all. And I would say it's come good for them and for us, because right now we're on the cusp of all of that, and it's cheaper than fossil fuels and requires less support.
Yeah.
Sorry, I lost my thread.
No, that's all good. You made an active choice at the start to go the business route rather than the charity route, but I'd imagine there are a lot of friends in that sector. Do you work much with charities, and is there an interaction and engagement in that manner?
Yeah, completely. We've probably got about 250 partners that we work with, and they're all sorts of groups, charities, NGOs, some are companies, and they're all in the same kind of space, the kind of green, sustainable, ethical kind of space. And we work with each other. We talk to each other's members. And, one of the kind of roles we see for ourselves is making it possible for people to take these steps to live more sustainably, but to make it easy for them. Because, I absolutely believe that people power is the way to bring the change to the world. But somebody has to make the product available, and has to make it easy, and has to make it cost effective and therefore accessible. We see that as our role. So we expanded our work a couple of years ago, probably several years ago now, from just being focused on energy to focusing on transport and food. Those three issues between them are responsible for 80% of everybody's personal carbon footprint, which is driven by fossil fuel consumption. Our main focus is still energy, electricity and gas, but in transport we built the Nemesis, the electric supercar.
Yeah.
I think we put it on the road in 2010, and that was born of an idea, really. I wanted a greener car, but at the time you couldn't buy an electric car anywhere in the world, so we thought we'd make one, and we thought we'd have to make a supercar, because if you ever set out to do something green, it's got to be great.
Yeah.
Otherwise people are yes but,
everyone will look at it and
but it's got shortcomings, hasn't it? So we made this car that was absolutely beautiful to look at, went like hell. We took the land speed record with it, and in the process we saw all the big car companies start to talk about EVs, electric cars, and figured that where we were really needed was in the infrastructure space. Where were people going to charge their cars? We built this thing called the electric highway. So that's our work in transport currently, is around electric vehicles. We've done a lot of number crunching. People say very valid questions. Where will all the electricity come from? How do we power 30 million cars in Britain? Where does the lithium come from? Is there enough to make all the batteries? Yeah. It's always important to us that the things that we do aren't a niche, that they are scalable.
Yeah.
So we did,
again, that's again having the business mentality rather than the charity mentality, of not just finding a potential solution, finding a potential replacement for wanting to take over all that business as such kind of thing, rather than thinking, oh, I could get this car and I could drive it,
you're right. I mean, it may be that way. From my perspective, it's about practicality. It's all very well me having an electric car, but if there's only enough lithium for 1% of the cars in the world to be electric, that's not the answer.
We have
to look somewhere else for the answer. But that wasn't the case. We found there's enough lithium. And then we looked at the UK grid. How much electricity do you think it would take to power 30 million cars driving about 250 billion miles a year in Britain?
Right.
Most people would think that's more than the grid could ever cope with. We crunched numbers and found it was a 13% increase in grid-delivered
power,
which is like 4 years' normal growth.
Yeah.
And actually, the demand comes at the off-peak time in the night time, so it kind of fits quite well, raises the load factor of the grid. It kind of works for us, not against us.
Yeah,
of course. That was an illuminating kind of find,
That's fascinating. Of course, the fact that Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. The fact that the point when everyone's turning off their lights and turning off their TVs and going to sleep is the point that they would be plugging in their their vehicles to take that energy, so it wouldn't be. It would be a nice spread of the actual energy and what is being drained out at that at that moment. That's fascinating. So what is the? Let's talk a bit about the electric highway, because when you talk about electric cars, so many people are excited about it and into it, but so many people I hear say, oh, I'd also want to have my other car, like they're just for, you know,
long journeys,
all things like that. If, you know, an electric car perfect for nipping into town for doing your day-to-day stuff, but for long journeys I need to know that I'm not going to suddenly be in the middle of the woods or fields with no power.
It's a comfort blanket thing, isn't
it?
You know, there's things
called... people forget that you know, I've been in the middle of the woods before with no petrol. This, you know, it's not a new thing in that way. So it's I guess it's finding that that way of having the electricity available enough.
Yeah, but there are two aspects to how I would answer that. One is, I think it's a range anxiety is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
people being worried that they can't get to where they want to go, they might run out of power. And it's actually, if you look more closely at how we use cars, they can cross continents, there's no doubt about it. You can fill them up in 5 minutes and you can drive 24/7 if you want to. But 99.6% of all car journeys in Britain are less than 100 miles.
Yeah.
99.6, it doesn't leave much.
It
does not leave much.
Yeah, it's great. It's that anxiety of something that you may never even encounter in your life.
And mostly don't.
Yeah.
Most of the time, do not drive over 100 miles. But the second part of the answer was for us to build the electric highway, and we focused on the motorways, figuring that where you're going to need to charge most is out on the open road, on the big roads, the motorways. Given that 99.6% of all car journeys were less than 100 miles, that was our starting place. Electric cars at that time had a range of about 100 miles. They're improving fast now. You know, 150, 200 is there today, and a couple of years from now it'll be 300. We figured it was the motorways. So we built at every motorway service station technology to charge cars. And when we began, it's very funny, 2010, 2011, we were really installing 3-pin plugs on the motorway service stations.
Wow.
And it would take 8 hours to charge a car full.
Yeah.
You know, we're very honest about it to the media. We said, we know it's not actually uber practical right now, although if you're in an electric car, you would be grateful for some power.
For the top up.
Something. But we know technology changing, and it comes back to the point I made earlier. You've got to constantly refresh your own understanding of the world and look forwards. Don't be dragged down by what's possible today. So we built this knowing that other stuff was coming. Within 2 years, faster than we thought, the technology was there to charge a car in 20 minutes.
Wow.
Time it takes to have a cup of coffee.
Wow.
Fantastic.
That's amazing. And again, I like that, because I think it's always hugely important to be as aware and critical of your own advances or ideas as you are of the opposition's as such. So the fact that you had found a solution, but were quite honest, like, not that much. It's a bit of a solution, but in reality, 8 hours to charge your car up isn't the ideal solution. But it's then striving forward and going, right, realistically, I mean, we can start this now, and it is a positive, as you said. And the fact is, at that point as well, there's not tens or hundreds of thousands of electric cars that you're having to provide for. So it's, you know, it's not like it's this unmanageable thing. So it's the perfect point to kind of, right, we've not got it perfect, but not everyone needs it yet. So it's worth starting at this point and then progressing forward, I guess.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's helped people. You know, there is a network in place now, and you can drive the length and breadth of the country in a car that only has 100-mile range. You can do it. And you just have to stop for 20 minutes, have a cup of coffee, and move on, you know. And it's a nice way to travel as well, actually, instead of trying to drive 300 miles all in one go.
Yeah.
Just break the journey up.
I mean, again, it's essential. Everyone always says how many accidents are caused by people not taking a break. And again, not to make any kind of spin that this is also saving lives, but there is an element of that. It is very tempting when you've got a full tank to just plug through because, oh, I've got so much more to go, I don't want to stop. Whereas if there is that, right, well, in 20 minutes I can refresh, I can charge up and be good to go. That's That's no bad thing there.
No, it's about enjoying the journey as well, isn't it? Rather than focusing on the destination. I mean, that's a kind of life choice. And, technology enables us to get from A to B as fast as possible, doesn't it? It's not always a good thing. Spiritually, it's not the best thing.
Yeah, and I agree. You mentioned food.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit from an energy point of view, because that's not something that springs to mind instantly. For me, I'm not sure. Again, you wouldn't expect to be talking to a power company about food. So what's the what is the interest and the focus there?
Yeah, well, just to re-mention, energy, transport and food being the big three, that's like a merit order. Energy is biggest, followed by transport, followed by food. But food and transport are very close together in terms of their emissions and impact and stuff. And quite simply, what we choose to eat has an enormous environmental impact. Mm-hmm. If we choose to eat meat and dairy, we have a massive impact. The worst offending meat is beef, and you have to put something like 10 kilos of high quality plant protein into a cow to get 1 kilo of beef out.
Right.
So it's incredible diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. You can feed basically 10 vegetarians or one meat eater, and in a planet with very limited resources and a fast growing population, you know, that can't ever make any sense. But I think since the end of the Second World War, the advent of very cheap and plentiful fossil fuels have delivered a very different agricultural system, intensive farming, for example, and it's changed our diet in the West. We eat far more meat and dairy than we used to. And if you look at the developing world, you see the kind of diet we might have had 50, 60 years ago. Only problem is because they're coming up this curve wanting to have a Western diet, generally speaking. I mean, that's happening in China and India, for example. And the world can't sustain it. So there's an imperative to actually tackle the food issue from that perspective. But also, it's incredibly cruel. Factory farming is a hideous, monstrous industry. The dairy industry has been very successful in its propaganda. It makes us all think that it's an entirely natural product, and it's quite cuddly. You know, it's okay. It's like a byproduct of nature. It isn't. Cows have to have their babies taken away from them at less than one day old. If it's a male cow, it gets shot in the head and fed to the hunt dogs or something. If it's a female cow, it follows its mother into the industry. But a cow has to be constantly pregnant and constantly having its babies taken away so that we can have the milk. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing natural about that either. We're the only species on the planet that drinks the milk of another species. Only we don't call it cow's milk, we just call it milk. It's become sanitized, you know, it comes in cartons, but actually it's from a cat. We wouldn't drink dog milk or horse milk or something like that. Or human milk, you know, for that matter. So it's incredibly cruel to animals. It's actually bad for our health, and it is very bad for the planet. So that's the dark story.
Yeah.
The light story is it's actually a really easy thing we can all do about it. It's like energy, just change where you get it from. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I was going to say, because, again, it's another incredibly tough battle is convincing meat eaters to go this way or vice versa, you know. So what's the approach then to go, right? Because from what you've said there, the bulk of the issues is the production, essentially, and the way in which we get this food and things like that. Because, again, I'm a meat eater, but, again, I'm a big believer, I don't know, in my little dream of living in a cabin, there would be meat eating in it, but it would be direct, eat my own, you know, eat, catch anything I eat and things like that. So rather than this big mass industry that we've built from it. So what's your outlooks and solutions there is in looking at where we get this stuff or what we do about any of this?
I think fundamentally there's this diminishing return problem, and you know, the idea of eating meat every day is a very modern thing, and it's sustained by cheap fossil fuels and intensive farming. In Britain today, we kill 1 billion animals every year.
Yeah,
it doesn't count fish, it's just animals. Mm-hmm. That's 30 million a day. I mean, it's a holocaust every day.
Yeah.
There is no way that we individually could sustain that diet living in that kind of lifestyle out in the country.
Yeah, of course.
And nor did we used to. Because if you were self-sustaining, you'd be growing your crops. And rather than stick 10 kilos in your cow to get one back out, you'd eat them yourself. And so our relationship with animals used to be very different.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's what I would say to that.
It has
to be very different in the future.
So what are your thoughts on where the change is should come or could come?
It's simply a diet thing, really.
Yeah.
You know,
I completely understand and see that as, again, a viable and sellable and workable and livable thing of even just gradual adjustments, as you were saying, the fact that it's meat every day isn't how we were built, isn't how we were meant to sustain. And that instantly, to me and to a lot of people who love meat, would go, no, I can see that. That makes some sense. So making those changes to make it, again, more sustainable in that manner, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I think eating less. I mean, it's a path. You haven't got to do it in a big bang.
Yeah,
you know, we're all on a path, you know. And we bump into this question, you know, every now and then, this whole kind of sustainability agenda. If you care about the environment and you take certain steps in your life, it doesn't mean you have to do everything. And it's the same in meat. You know, some people give it up on a Monday.
Yeah.
And some people only eat it on a Monday.
Yeah, sure.
Both of those are steps.
Yeah.
I don't eat it at all. But our work in food has really been through our football club, Forest Green.
Yep. I was going to bring that up next. I was seeing a nice Forest Green Rovers a trophy there. So, yeah.
Nice shirt behind you there.
Yeah, there's a good collection. So what's the story there? Again, that's not a typical power company.
The play.
Yeah.
No, quite right. That was something we got involved in 2010. I think I've said 2010 a lot recently. That's a big year for us.
You did a lot in 2010. That was a hell of a year.
Yeah, I think we did. We rescued our local football club, basically. It was over 100 years old and big part of its community and lovely people, lovely facilities and stuff, but just completely kind of out of its league, really, unsustainable. So we stepped in to rescue it. Having been told they only need a little bit of money, it turned out it was a massive problem. And we faced the choice of seeing it go bankrupt or really getting involved deeply. And so we chose the latter, but decided that we would use it as an opportunity to take our message on energy, transport and food into a new world, the world of football, which I tend to think of as being a decade or two behind the curve.
It's not very modern. Yeah, that's completely fair.
And the first kind of big challenge we bumped into really was diet.
Yeah.
You know, because within a few weeks, I remember sitting up in our hospitality suite and seeing what we were feeding our players, and it was a minced beef lasagna or something. And I was like, oh God, I hadn't realised that I'm now basically involved in the meat trade.
Yeah.
And actually, it's bad for athletes.
Yeah, completely.
So we immediately said, look, we can't do this. We've got to feed our players better food than that. And actually, we can't stop there. It has to be across the whole stadium, staff, visitors, fans, everybody.
Amazing.
We banned red meat, as they like to say. It wasn't quite like that. We didn't ban it. We just said we're not going to have it on the menu. But
yes,
in the media, it was red meat banned. Got loads of headlines and caused a bit of trouble.
I'd imagine banning red meat at football.
Yeah, exactly.
Outrageous, but yeah.
It was. And it was very challenging. But we said to our fans, look, we aren't telling you what to eat, because that was one of the accusations thrown at us. You can bring whatever you want to a football game. What we're saying is we aren't going to have it on our menu. And on average, a football game at home is once every fortnight.
Yeah.
We said, don't come to a game and try to eat what you normally eat every other day of the week. Why don't you come to a game and try something different? And that's what we did. We put on a whole range of different food. And our focus is not about what's not in the food. It's about what the food is.
Yeah.
Is it great food or not?
That's what matters.
So this year we went vegan. It was a few weeks ago. It was another big media kind of splash. Went around the world, that one.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. But we'd already gone vegan quietly a few months ago, except for the milk in the tea. But all the food, pretty much, was vegan already.
Yeah.
Which was a kind of nice way to do it. But, you know, we've come on this journey 4 or 5 years in, and our fans have come with us. We put on this great veggie burger, and you can ask just about anybody at our club now that says it's just so much better than the old meat burger.
Yeah.
You know.
Again, it's not like football grounds have ever been a home of of high cuisine.
The bar was low.
In any way, the bar was low. The burgers were cold. Chips were covered in something glowing often. But yeah, so how did the staff and players initially take to that? I mean, obviously there's the public reaction, but how was the?
Well, the players were up for it because. You know, they're keen to do their very best, perform to their best. And so the conversation we had with them was based on a performance angle, saying that actually this stuff slows you down, you know. So they were completely up for it. And we were feeding them corn, I think, as the main protein alternative at the time, which wasn't vegan, but it's just gone vegan a couple of weeks ago. Well, not the whole range, but there's a vegan range of corn now,
right, that's great.
Which is what we sell up at the club.
And again, it's something I think that corn were actually quite... wise to do was when they started to get kind of athletes endorsing, yeah, and as part of that to say, look, this isn't, again, this isn't just a hippie thing or anything else, saying this is great for performance, yeah, this is giving you what you need for, yeah, to be a high level person, rather than this is what you need and you'll survive, yeah, it won't kill you to eat it, but you'll survive, but more saying, yeah, this can make you, yeah, all the better.
Yeah, I think somebody came at me that way from the media recently, you know, kind of you know, how do the players manage, or it's good that you're top of the league despite that.
Yeah,
and it's actually,
yeah,
the other way around, you know.
Yeah,
it actually helps. But what you touch upon there is exactly right for cars as well. You know, as I was saying, if you're going to make an electric car, it's got to be great.
Yeah,
and actually,
yeah,
the way to sell an electric car, I think, is the way they are to drive. I don't know if you've tried one, but they're fantastic.
Yeah,
oh, they're fantastic, and they make expert drivers out of anybody because there are no gears and you have instant maximum power and torque from one revolution. There's no power curve.
Wow.
So every time you come out of a corner, you're at the best place in the power curve, in the best gear to accelerate as fast as you can.
Amazing.
Makes everybody an expert driver.
Yeah,
they're fun, easy to drive, and fast if you want them to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and by the way, they don't make pollution.
Yeah, again, it's that great thing. And again, it's never a straight out the gate thing. Of initially, when electric cars were coming, but I'm sure again, there's at least the first ones that were coming on the market, there would be question marks over, yeah, if they can perform against this, if they can perform against that. But as you said, as soon as you've started to get that a technology there, gradually it will become undeniable. Yeah. Gradually we will know this is a better car. And it's actually, again, the same as with the energy. It's no harder for you.
Yeah.
What's the kind of the hurdles price-wise at the moment? Is it possible to make an affordable, strong performance electric car still? And
oh, totally, yeah. And I mean, the price is coming down really quickly.
Yeah,
you know,
because again, that was an initial thing. The first high performance electric cars that came out, yeah, were incredibly expensive.
Even the first average performance,
yeah,
cars,
yeah, expensive. Yeah.
No doubt about it. But you know, it's analogous to the first mobile phones,
yeah,
and the first laptops. You know,
yeah,
I mean, they came down in price incredibly and size, didn't they?
Yeah,
in both cases.
And I mean, performance.
First mobile phones were that big, weren't they?
Yeah.
One, the battery lasted 1 hour.
Yeah. Yeah, then plug it into the windmill.
Yeah, I used to do that.
Yeah, perfect.
And so cars are moving very quickly, electric cars. And, you know, it helps that every manufacturer now has one on the books. There are 30 models on the road to choose from.
Wow.
So there's a wide range. The batteries keep getting more energy dense, and that's the key, you know, to performance. And they keep getting cheaper. And as they go into mass production, like phones and laptops did, they just keep getting cheaper.
Yeah.
That's the way of things.
So we're at the hour mark, so I'll start to wrap up. Initially, so what's the plan going forward? What's your vision and for everything for going forward as a company and hopefully as a country?
Well, I suppose our big vision thing is Green Britain.
Yeah.
You know, our flag, which is sat here behind me, is a Green Union Jack.
Yeah.
And in that vision, we all live more sustainably. We do crack the issues of energy, transport, and food. And actually, energy is written through all of those three like a stick of rock. You know, it's energy in transport that's,
yep,
the key. It's energy in food that's actually,
yep,
the key.
Yep.
We've got enough of it in Britain. So, you know, the key to the whole thing really is to power the whole country from sustainable sources, to create industry and jobs. It's the other thing I wanted to say, actually. Most recently, we've evolved our message to not talking about green stuff as being good to do for its own sake. You know, we all care about polar bears, but actually what people care about more is industry and jobs, sustainable, yeah, economies. And we commissioned some research just before the election from Cambridge Econometrics about what Britain could look like in 2030 if we did some of the things that we've been talking about. We set out a range of policies that could achieve that. We got some stunning economic outcomes that show that actually these things lead to a stronger, sustainable economy, which is a completely different way to look at it. So that's our vision, a green Britain in which we make stuff here. We have jobs in industry making green stuff. We have, you know, no pollution. We live longer and all that kind of stuff.
It's exactly those kind of points, the jobs, the economy, that will, as we said earlier, will push people over that extra edge. It's absolutely fine to care about the environment and being green, but then when one of the partners in the family have lost their job, and you're doing your best to scrape by. Yeah. You then go for what is affordable for you at that moment, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's no selfishness there. That's a natural human.
You've got to do what you've got to do, yeah. Which is why people are burning the rainforest.
Yeah,
because they need some way to live. I get that. I mean, my favorite way to paraphrase this is the way Bill Clinton didn't say it. Yeah. It's the green economy, stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
That's our new message.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's perfect. So where can people keep up to date with everything that you guys are doing here, and what's the best way? Again, as we got it in earlier, let's make sure it's at the end as well. If they do want to change their electricity over to Ecotricity, where do they go and what do they do?
Give us a call or just go on the internet, check our website out. It's electricity and gas now, of course. It's very easy to do, and the more people join us, the more we can do. We've got this bills into mills model. We see ourselves making a utility bill, which is like a necessary evil. Nobody likes having one, do they?
No.
Actually, our customers like having our bills because they know some good comes from it, and that's what we do. We're just turning that into good stuff.
It's a small bit of positivity when each time you have to pay that bill. And again, just the highlighting that nothing changes, essentially. It's the part that I hadn't understood. I think, if I'm honest, until we had this conversation, not that I'd thought about it a lot, but it's still plugging into the same grid. It's just now it's you guys who are providing it and you guys who are buying it off of. It's not suddenly the gas has to come down a hill from a windmill and go round here coming. It's the same stuff provided, but it's just for a better cause.
I mean, the real difference is where your money goes.
Yeah,
it's who you pay and what they do with your money. That's the difference.
Yeah, so instead of putting it in the, and again, it's an issue I always had with, and again, we won't even start going on the economic side of mortgages and rent culture in the UK now, but when I first moved out, the thing that I struggled with the most was thinking, so my rent would cost the same as a mortgage, except my rent is going in the pocket of some big company and some, whereas my mortgage was, admittedly, there's the banks and everything else, but my mortgage is essentially going towards me owning this and me having my own piece of land and own place to live, essentially. And it's a similar thinking there. I think you could put your money, that horrible bill you get each month, that could go towards making someone who's very rich even more rich, essentially. Or it could go towards, as I said, a little smile on your face as it's generating more meals and more.
Changing the world.
Yeah.
And that's what we're really here for.
Yeah, that's perfect. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been lovely to chat.
It's been my great pleasure as well. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. How dope is that? How inspirational. I really enjoyed that. As said, I went in sceptical on a lot of things. Only thing we really butted heads on even slightly was on meat. And it wasn't a big argument. I'm not against vegans or vegetarians or anyone else, but it annoys me at times when vegans or vegetarians are so far beyond, so far against meat eaters. I don't know, it's a weird one. I was at the live show, and I'm not having a go because it's listeners and that's great and supportive. At the live show, I had a great chat that I felt was positive and engaging with a young lady who was a vegan. I had a good conversation and she gave me a book that was a kind of comic book about a veganism. And I got home later and I started to read it and I found it incredibly offensive. it was very derogatory towards meat eaters, a very mocking of meat eaters, and it just felt, man, imagine if I had a book that was just like pages and pages of laughing at vegans and I gave that to a vegan, I think that'd be hugely rude and offensive. And I don't think the person was being rude or intending to be rude, but yeah, I never got around to mentioning that. I found it quite an odd and offensive book in that manner. But again, I'm not against anyone having their own beliefs and doing what they do. I just think people should at times be more respectful of other people's
beliefs and choices, which is tough. If your beliefs are strong and someone else's beliefs are, you know, against yours, then I get that. That kind of thing happens. But yeah, anyway, that wasn't what I was here to talk about. That was the only bit we really batted heads on in the podcast. But still, I agreed with a lot of his stuff, and I still agree in that in general, humans should reduce their meat intake. I think in doing so, we would hopefully then reduce the meat industry, which is kind of gross in places, and there is some horribleness there. So there's a lot we did agree on. So a fascinating one. I hope you'll agree. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I would love it if you would go and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or give us 5-star ratings and reviews and stuff like that. That means a lot. It makes a difference. It helps our reputation within iTunes and within the charts and things like that. So that'd be cool if you can do that or spread the word directly. I mean, but again, if you can only do one thing after listening to this one, I'd say that one is go and check out Ecotricity, and if it's an option for you in your household and with your power bills and electric and gas and everything, because, man, it's simple. It's just a simple switch over. So, yeah, I think that's everything I needed to talk about. I think we're at the end of the podcast, right? Yeah, that's it. Hopefully next week, I'm recording this intro a fair bit in advance, but the plan is that next week we have Itch from King Blues on, and then there'll be one or two or three or four episodes of a year in review, and that's going to be me. The plan is my mates Stu Whiffin and Chris Glasson, who run A Wretch of Rebels, who really sponsors the podcast and have supported me for a long time, and they also run my We Are Lizards club night with me. And I chose them because I thought if I'm going to do a year in review, then it's perfect that it's with two people. I was trying to get my brother as well because he does the door at my club night. And generally, we meet up once a month to do the club night, and we drink and discuss what's been going on that month, whether that be films, MMA, music, podcasts, not just mine, but other podcasts, and the general news. So I thought that'd be interesting people to sit down and do it with. But we do generally do that once a month whilst getting drunk. So the plan is to set the mics up, to sit down with some drinky drinks, and to go through month by month and see how many episodes of the podcast that turns into. That could turn into 5-6 weeks in a row. But yeah, we'll see how that goes. And yeah, the plan is to discuss some serious stuff, some not serious stuff. Even I'm going to prepare a load of news stories and releases and stuff like that that have happened in that time. But I'm also going to encourage the guys to make some notes or stuff that they've, even in their private life or personal life, just interesting stuff that they've been up to or thought about or done. So let's see how that goes. Thank you for tuning in, guys. This has been the Distraction Pieces podcast with Scroobius Pip, which is me. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.